Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, August 8th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, election unrest potential sparks work on neutral observers program. Eureka police caught in the middle of Cal Poly use of force audit. And residents urge to avoid harmful algal blooms amid summer risks. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. The Eureka City Council heard the report from their independent police auditor for the department's use of force at Cal Poly Humboldt in April, and they heard a preliminary version of an ordinance to outlaw empty buildings in Eureka. Kelly Lincoln reports.
Tuesday, August 6th, the Eureka City Council spent an hour receiving a police oversight report on Eureka Police Department's response to the Cal Poly Humboldt sit-in at Siemens Hall. That was the protest organized by Cal Poly students voicing objections to the university's investments that may be contributing to the bombing of Palestinians in Gaza. Eureka City Council also reviewed an introductory version of an ordinance being proposed to discourage unoccupied buildings within Eureka City limits. On April 22nd, the Eureka Police Department responded to a mutual aid call from the campus police on Cal Poly Humboldt campus when students protesting the bombing of occupied Palestinians seized control of Siemens Hall. Eureka's Police Chief Brian Stevens said,
"So on April 22, 2024, approximately 5:30 p.m., EPD received a request from Cal Poly Humboldt for assistance with a group of protesters that had entered and then occupied Siemens Hall on the Cal Poly campus. The initial response authorized was one sergeant and four officers. This allowed us to maintain our staffing responsibilities for the city and police the city. Not exactly sure how long it took, but within that first probably hour and a half, a code 30 request came out from Cal Poly from the personnel on scene."
Code 30 calls are rare.
So, Councilmember, countywide code 30 is a call for assistance from any agency in the county based on a circumstance that they're facing that's out of control, out of their realm of control, that needs immediate code 3 response by any available officers, deputies within our county because of the situation's out of control. The times I've seen it used, I've used it once probably 20 years ago with a large fight we had in the middle of Fifth Street when a nightclub let out. I've seen it used when an officer was shot in Arcata at the plaza. They call for a code 30. It got used when one of our officers was injured in a traffic collision as a part of pursuit, and the suspect was still fleeing, and we had a lot of stuff going on. An outside agency actually was on scene when it happened and called for a code 30 because we had an officer down. So those are generally the types of circumstances that they're used for. From an agency standpoint, when it's called, we evaluate what's the response needed, what is that emergency they're calling us for, how many people can I send and still be able to maintain control of my own city, my own jurisdiction, be able to police that, and then are they giving us enough direction on where to go and what we're facing so that those officers or deputies that are responding know what they're going to encounter when they get there.
Altogether, Eureka's police department sent 20 officers who were on scene at least 4 hours. Additionally, there was a task force that stayed on duty in Eureka to monitor the protests at the courthouse as a result of arrests that had been made at Siemens Hall. Subsequently, the Eureka City Council asked for an independent review by Eureka's police auditor, the OIR Group, out of Long Beach. Tuesday, they received a presentation on that report. The report reads in part, "The Eureka Police Department team recognized that law enforcement was significantly outnumbered. Without a clear path of ingress and egress, there appeared to be no feasible way to accomplish a mass arrest. Moreover, the Eureka Police Department officers appeared to be the only responding team equipped with shields that are required for effective crowd management. Despite these circumstances, University Police Command gave orders to enter the hall and begin arresting protesters. Because they had shields, 4 EPD officers found themselves at the front of line in the Siemens Hall foyer, along with at least one Humboldt County Sheriff's deputy. Chief Stevens described what happened to an officer as the force tried to enter the building that night. Julia Rulin with the Independent Auditor OIR Group told the council that Chief Stevens has been fully cooperative and she praised him for implementing the recommendations quickly. Teresa Magula of the OIR Group said the basis of confusion lies in the mutual aid agreements that are a vital part of rural law enforcement responses.
We did not, in our review of this, see any kind of immediate threat that would have warranted a law enforcement response to the hall in the way that it occurred. That was, again, outside the span of control of EPD. There was certainly reports of vandalism. Perhaps there was concerns about trespassing in the hall, but none of those would really warrant removing individuals from the hall or having that plan in the first place. I keep talking about span of control, and so some of the questions that you might be having might be, well, why didn't the EPD officers or supervisor on the scene do anything about that? Really, this points to some challenges with mutual aid. Mutual aid is a critical factor in law enforcement responses, especially in a community like yours, as Chief Stevens has already mentioned. It is essential that agencies are able to respond to help each other out when that need arises. But that can be really complicated, right? So officers arrived onto the scene, and they did not have the appropriate direction and command. But they were also somewhat limited in their ability to speak up about their concerns with what they saw when they arrived. We mentioned in our report that there was concerns raised by the supervisor in the course of listening to the body-worn camera footage. And it's difficult to have a supervisor speak those concerns to another agency's chief of police. We think it's, of course, very important because of those kind of command structure challenges and mutual aid challenges that these agencies have a plan and communication well in advance of these types of incidents occurring. In particular, in this case, we had the influence of university administrators who had a particular goal in mind without perhaps understanding what that would look like being executed in the field. So they said, we want the building cleared. We want you to go in and arrest people. And I don't know that there was the communication and the discussion either at the moment or prior to that of what something like that looks like in real life.
Councilmember Mario Fernandez asked,
if we have the training, we have the resources, and we're being called to a situation that's at least on a smaller scale, similar to what had occurred in 2020, because I see it as a First Amendment issue, you know, with students expressing themselves. Of course, you know, UPD can feel how they feel. I'm just trying to figure it out. How is it that, you know, our officers are called there, but again, our chief has to show up and take command of the situation, or not necessarily take command of the situation, but be the one to offer the directives that would result in.
But City Attorney Autumn Luna.
And I just want to mention that this is a receive report situation. And so I think if we want to talk about how to do things differently or better in the future, we need to agendize that specifically. This is not an action item. So
the council says it will review its mutual aid policies and agreements in a future session. In another matter, the Eureka City Council heard from the city attorney regarding proposed ordinance 1038-CS, which hopes to resolve the problem of blight caused by unoccupied buildings. The proposed ordinance defines vacant buildings as any building or structure which is not being put to a lawful commercial, residential, or industrial use. City Attorney Luna said that while current municipal codes are used to compel building owners to upkeep and maintain their buildings, whether they are occupied or not, this ordinance will obligate owners to pay a fee for the city to inspect those buildings quarterly, and it will institute fines of $1,000 a month for the first year and $5,000 a month thereafter. Two council members and the mayor were not at the meeting, so the ordinance was tabled for a future meeting. This is Kelly Lincoln reporting for KMUD News.
With a contentious presidential election drawing near, Humboldt County's Human Rights Commission is working on a neutral observers program. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County's Human Rights Commission, or HRC, is aiming to launch a program where neutral observers keep watch at conflict-prone events like protests. At its August 1st meeting, the HRC discussed forming a committee on a neutral observers program. Committee members agreed that the need for creating a program with trained neutral observers is imminent, as the November presidential election could trigger extreme responses. Committee member Carol Larson said that with the election at hand, quote, there may be some volatile community participation or displays, and there's a question of, will we have a response to that? Committee Chair Jim Glover said one of the formative committee's key tasks will be to define, quote, what rises to the level of the neutral observers being activated. Committee member Larry Miller said some organizing has already taken place, and he described the need for the subcommittee as pressing.
We have some folks that have volunteered to at least serve or start in being involved in that, the development of the neutral observers. I'm hoping that we can do in-person meeting sometime this coming week. I think because of the election and the volatility of that we really do need to have something in place as soon as possible.
Describing what neutral observers do, Miller read from an outline based on training manuals.
Our role as neutral observers is to be present at events such as the protests, demonstrations, and rallies that take place in Humboldt County, and to serve as witnesses of the actions and behaviors of the parties present at the event. Observers are trained to make observations, not value judgments or interpretations in the event that a situation has arisen that presents potential harm to persons or property. The observers make note of what they see. When appropriate, observers will write a report of their observations. The reports are on file and open to inspection.
Committee member Guy Aronoff suggested presence of neutral observers would have been helpful with the recent anti-Israel protests at Cal Poly Humboldt.
I've been actively involved as a volunteer with OES for emergencies like we're having right now with the fires and everything, not related necessarily, but I was rather surprised when I heard from my boss over there that they got called up and called in all these cops that came, the CHP and everybody, and I'm thinking, why? And it really, I think, makes this neutral observer committee important because, quite honestly, what happened at the college got out of hand, and probably, you know, because of ineffectual administration. And then they brought the sheriffs in, and the sheriffs came in there like we were being attacked by the Russians. It's like, what the heck? You have 300 officers over here because they had 35 people that were protesting peacefully on campus.
The confrontational protests included vandalism and an occupation and barricading of Cal Poly's Siemens Hall. Humboldt County Sheriff Billy Hansel will meet with the HRC in October to discuss homelessness-related issues, and committee members agreed that discussion on neutral observers could also happen then. Miller said law enforcers, quote, need to have a comfort level with neutral observers. They need to know we're good guys or girls. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The Emerald Triangle is renowned for its natural beauty, including some of the best swimming holes in the state. As summer heats up, many people flock to local rivers to enjoy the weather. However, those warm temperatures also create ideal conditions for toxic algae, which have led to the tragic loss of pets and caused illness in children and vulnerable adults. The Humboldt County Department of Health and Human Services is reminding residents to exercise caution and avoid harmful algal blooms.
My name is Benjamin Dolph. I'm the supervisor of the Consumer Protection Program for the Humboldt County Division of Environmental Health. Harmful algal blooms are a species of various species of cyanobacteria that when conditions are favorable, such as low river flows, warmer water temperatures, and the potential for nutrient loading in the rivers, they can cause a bloom or a rapid growth. And during that time, they produce toxins that are harmful to people and animals.
Cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae, are common in freshwater and estuaries. These organisms have been around for billions of years and are essential components of aquatic ecosystems, serving as a food source and producing oxygen. When conditions are favorable, algae and cyanobacteria can rapidly multiply, causing blooms. These blooms can sometimes be seen as scum or discoloration on the water's surface. Blooms can appear in various colors, including green, blue, yellow, red, or brown. However, the cyanotoxins produced by cyanobacteria cannot be seen in the water or tissue.
Unfortunately, identifying the various species and whether they're harmful or not is fairly nuanced. There isn't any clear-cut identification features. And frequently harmful algal species can occur in conjunction with harmless species. So it's even difficult for some of our staff to identify exactly what or the likelihood of harmful toxins being produced in a particular area is. We do frequently take photographs and send them to the state, who is a bit more experienced in identifying the harmful species. And if there is a concern based on the visual observations, on occasion, we will collect samples, and the state can identify if harmful toxins are being produced and at a level that could cause a risk to public health.
Cyanobacteria warnings typically begin in late July and early August, when low water flows and sustained high temperatures in inland areas contribute to cyanobacteria growth in local rivers and lagoons. While most cyanobacterias are harmless, some can produce toxins that pose a risk to animals and humans. The DHHS is working with the State Department of Water Quality to monitor cyanobacteria levels, track toxic blooms, and post warnings at popular swimming holes. But it's important to use caution when recreating in any body of water during this time of year, as not all locations may have visible warnings, even if cyanobacteria is present.
First and foremost, it's avoiding areas where there's a large amount of algal growth. And if the water doesn't look clean, it doesn't look inviting, it probably should be avoided. And obviously, if those are the conditions when you're at the river, keep kids and dogs away from the water. Dogs and children can even get sick from, kids are less likely to ingest algae, but the mats and the scum that's washed up and dried up on the riverbank, that can still contain toxins. And those little stagnant pools that are sort of off the side of the river, those can be significantly or definitely problematic, and dogs are often susceptible because they'll be wading in it, they'll lick themselves clean, they're ingesting a higher level of these toxins if they're exposed. Currently, we haven't had any confirmed blooms locally yet this year. Really, the rivers of concern are the most popular rivers because they're seeing the greatest amount of public use. These blooms can occur everywhere. The harmful species of algae are endemic. They've always been here. We've just been learning more about the toxicity over time. So these blooms can occur, and usually the best swimming holes are where the water is slow, where the water is warm, where the conditions for algae can occur. So a lot of it is being vigilant when visiting the river, but most popular places are where we have the highest concern.
According to the state's HABS monitoring map, there are currently no confirmed blooms in local waterways. However, Lake Pillsbury, part of the Potter Valley Project Dam that feeds into the Eel River, shows extremely high levels of HABS. The state has created the California Harmful Algal Bloom Portal, which serves as both an informational resource for the public and a tool for coordination with statewide partners to address HABS. The content is developed by the California Cyanobacteria and HAB Network and participating state agencies.
The State Water Resources Control Board has a method or a website for reporting a bloom, and it lets you provide photos and fill out a form to essentially report the bloom. They also have a hotline that allows people to report blooms by phone. And on that site, there is also, they maintain a interactive map that shows all of California where blooms have been reported, if they've been investigated and tested, and if there's any active warnings or postings on particular water bodies.
The website for the HABS portal is mywaterquality.ca.gov/HABS. Residents are encouraged to report any suspected HABS and to practice healthy water habits at local lakes, rivers, and streams.
We do rely heavily on the public reporting concerns when they see water conditions being concerning. We have limited eyes and ears out in the field, but we definitely encourage the public to report primarily to the state or to our office if they have concerns about a harmful algal bloom. We would definitely investigate. Be cautious if you're going to a water body that does have postings posted. We have general warnings for be cautious of algae, but we also have more specific signs if a bloom has been identified in any particular location. So look in the kiosks, look on billboards, look at trailheads to see if there's any postings present at the local swimming holes.
To report a suspected bloom, you can email cyanohab.reports@waterboards.ca.gov, or you can call 844-729-6466 toll-free. You can also report blooms via the Bloom Watch app, which is available to download on your smart device. On August 9th, bands and community will come together for an Old Town Community Alliance benefit in Arcata. KMUD's Lisa Music brings us the details.
Swingo Domingo will be playing a benefit for Old Town Community Alliance tomorrow, August 9th, in Arcata. Ari, a member of Swingo Domingo, shares the importance of community support for this grassroots organization.
I've been aware of the work that Old Town Community Alliance has been doing for the last several years just through my own, personal outreach efforts to the houseless population of Humboldt. Pretty much that's what they do. It's a grassroots organization, volunteer-based, and they do quarterly community events where they directly provide the community with all kinds of survival gear, food, clothing, tents, propane, all those sorts of things. And as we all know, especially recently with these Supreme Court rulings, it's becoming more and more challenging and illegal even to exist in a houseless space. So I feel really very passionately and strongly to step up as an artist, as a musician, as a community member, just to do what I can, what we can collectively to provide basic needs for folks that are just doing their best to survive.
The benefit allows community members to enjoy a fun night while supporting a noble cause.
Oftentimes people feel overwhelmed and inundated by everything happening right now, but something that I find a lot of comfort in as a community member is knowing that, you know, we all can do our small part and we can do, really seemingly minor things in our day to help those that need help the most right now. So oftentimes people, they want to get involved, they want to help. And one of the best things you can do, especially if you're short on time, is just hand over some cash. And that tends to help get the gears going. You know, all we have is each other, and we got to look out for each other, especially now.
Ari describes Swingo Domingo's style.
So we are what we like to call swing pop. We do covers mostly from the 80s and 90s, but we like to mix it up and reimagine the songs in a more jazzy fashion. So oftentimes people will hear our stuff and they'll be like, oh gosh, that's so familiar. I swear I know this song. And it's not till the end that they figure it out. So we kind of like to put our own twist on things. So yeah, it's going to be fun, upbeat, dancey music. And, you know, it's a bit eclectic, kind of out there. We like to get weird. So it should be a lot of fun.
The benefit will be held at Richard's Goat Tavern, located at 900 Samoa Boulevard in Arcata.
So this coming Friday, August 9th, we will be at Richard's Goat Tavern and Tea Room in Arcata. We have three bands lined up, three local amazing groups that also feel very strongly about these issues. We've got House of Mary, ourselves, Swingo Domingo, and Royal Propolis playing this Friday at Richard's Goat. Show starts at 8:30, goes till midnight. We have a sliding scale entry fee, $5 to $10. No one's turned away for lack of funds, but every cent that you spend at the door is going to go directly to this organization, Old Town Community Alliance, so they can fund their winter outreach, because we're coming up on the colder months, and that's when they need the most help.
Those wanting to preview Swingo Domingo's style have multiple options to view the local band's information online.
We've got a website, swingodomingo.com. We're on Instagram, Facebook, at Swingo Domingo. We try to keep our website and everything updated. We have a couple shows this month after this particular gig.
The bar opens at 6 p.m. and music starts after 8:30 p.m. $5 to $10 sliding scale, though no one will be turned away for lack of funds.
So we'd love to see everyone out.
Reporting for KMUD, I'm Lisa Music.
In state news, the Park Fire continues to burn in four Northern California counties. Audie McAfee reports.
According to CAL FIRE, this is the biggest fire in California this year. It's burned over 400,000 acres and is the fifth largest fire in California history. Almost 7,000 personnel have been deployed to fight the blaze. The fire has destroyed 636 structures and damaged 49 others. No injuries have been reported. Rachel Bowen is the public information officer for CAL FIRE's Tehama Glen unit. She says the fire is unpredictable, so residents should stay informed.
So this is a dynamic fire. We encourage citizens to have their go bags ready in case of an evacuation order and to continue to visit readyforwildfire.org.
According to the Butte County Sheriff's Office, over 4,000 people have been evacuated, with thousands more under evacuation warnings. Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency for Butte and Tehama County soon after the fire started. The governor says California also secured a fire management assistance grant from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to ensure there are enough resources to deal with the fire. CAL FIRE's Rachel Bowen says containment has been difficult.
So the fire is presenting its own challenges based on steep, rugged terrain with limited access points.
Officials say the three things that drive fire are fuel, weather, and topography, which all contributed to the size and strength of the Park Fire. The day the fire started, the weather was above 100 degrees with extremely low humidity. Rick Carhart is the public information officer for CAL FIRE's Butte County unit. He urged local residents to abide by evacuation orders.
So we only put them out when there is a serious, real threat. And so if the sheriff's office puts out an evacuation order, it's for a reason, and it is in everybody's best interest to definitely get out.
Carhart says firefighters are working as hard as possible so the Butte and Tehama County sheriff's offices can lift evacuation orders and people can return to their homes. For KPFA, I'm Audie McAfee.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler. And thanks to our reporters, Kelly Lincoln, Daniel Mintz, Lisa Music, and Audie McAfee. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, related documents, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send us an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.